You are listening to Adventures in Buddhism. I'm your host, Morris Sullivan. I belong to a few Buddhism-related social media groups, and in one of these, this fellow recently asked a question along the lines of this: if I'm not pursuing enlightenment, is there any point in practicing Buddhism? I thought it was an interesting question, and the answer, I think, depends largely on what you mean by enlightenment. But also, people approach this practice for any number of reasons. Sometimes we start out meditating or attending services for one reason, but our purpose grows and changes as we continue. There's a story in the Lotus Sutra that talks about this. A man had run away from home at a very young age. Over time, he became completely destitute. He was traveling around the country trying to eke out a living. And eventually, quite by accident, he returned to his hometown. After he had left home, his father had become a very successful, very wealthy man. For many years, he had been wishing for his son to return. And now his life was coming closer to an end, and he had begun to fear that his wealth would be scattered after his death. Well, when his son showed up at the palace looking for work, he recognized him right away, and he was overjoyed. But his son saw this grand palace, and he was afraid. He had no idea that he was at his father's house, and he had spent so long living in poverty, he felt that he had no business at such a grand place, and so he turned around and started to leave. His father sent servants to bring him back, and when this happened, he was terrified. He thought that they were coming to accuse him of a crime, and he fainted from fear that he was going to be thrown into a prison or something. His father realized that if he wanted his son to be a part of the household, that he was going to have to be more subtle. So he had some servants dress up in soiled rags and seek him out, and they offered his son a job cleaning up trash and filth around the palace. Well, his son felt like he was up to that task, and he accepted that job. Over the course of the next several years, the man kept telling his foreman to give his son more and more responsibility. Finally, the father realized that his son had become able to accept his full kindness, and he revealed to him the truth of his birth. His son had become able to see himself as capable of being an heir to a successful man, and being a successful man himself. Like that son, when we first come to hear the Dharma, we may just be looking for relief from our stress. We can't imagine that we can achieve any sort of awakening. But as we work with the teachings that we can grasp, we begin to develop some understanding and kindness. In time, we can develop a great capacity for our own wisdom and compassion. And only then can we accept the kindness of a Buddha who wants to help us also become Buddhas. I talked a few weeks ago about Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Mahasattvas and stuff like that, and the question came up because I said something about enlightenment. What is enlightenment? And it's a very good question. You know, if I didn't believe enlightenment was possible, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be a Buddhist if I didn't think that enlightenment was possible. And there are enough people around who I think have experienced what we consider at least a glimpse of it, that I think we can safely say that enlightenment exists, and that it's a goal worth pursuing, and that we can experience enlightenment in some form. Even if we don't experience what the Buddha would have referred to as total unbinding, you know, complete liberation from the cycle of coming and going in this lifetime, then I think we can at least move toward it and in the process gain some freedom from spiritual constraints. Now, I just used a word I shouldn't have used. I used the word gain. So, you should never think of spiritual progress in terms of gain and loss. Think of it in terms of experience. And what you do, what we do is what is important here. When the Buddha talked about what it meant to be enlightened, he spoke in terms of seven factors: mindfulness, keen investigation of the Dharma, effort, happiness, calm, concentration, and equanimity. So it's interesting, we think of enlightenment as a state a lot of times. You know, where do you go when you're enlightened? You know, this beam, shaft of light comes down from the heavens and shines on you, and suddenly you're awake. Things like that. Things that happen to us or create a certain state of mind. But if you look at these terms, I think you see them more as skills. These are skills that we can develop. And we develop skills by doing things, by working with things. You develop the skill of playing the piano by sitting down at a piano and playing. And so if you look at enlightenment in terms of these factors, then enlightenment, I think you could see as something more as something that you do rather than as something that you get or something that happens to you. There's this phrase that comes up a lot in Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism: samsara is nirvana. So samsara is the cycle of coming and going. And this is what we have here, right now, this moment, is our place in that cycle. And we can experience nirvana without having to die and not be reborn. We can experience nirvana here. We talk in the service about the Pure Land. And the Pure Land is a state of faith. Faith in the active sense, not faith in the, oh, well, I'm told to believe this, so I'm going to say it sense. But in the sense of, I have established my heart on something important, and that's going to guide my actions. That's the faith. So we live in the Saha world, which is the existence in which everything that is comes up of, that is made of other things, including us, is unstable. And therefore, sooner or later, going to become a little bit on the disappointing side. But even in the Saha world, we can experience the Pure Land. Dogen, the founder of my particular tradition, talked about Buddha nature. Sort of one of his conundrums was, if we all possess Buddha nature, why do we have to work so hard? And the realization he came to in time was that when we bow to the Buddha, when we sit in silence, when we do these things, that is our Buddha nature taking form. So I'll talk a little bit about each of the seven factors of enlightenment and just kind of touch the surface of the subject. We talk about these things in more depth all the time. But so what are these ways, what are these skills that we should develop? What fields of activity and mental states can we create with our actions? And the first one is mindfulness. So we have whole retreats on the subject of mindfulness here, but mindfulness really means being aware of what's going on in the present moment. But that doesn't mean that it's enough to just sort of be in the moment. You are develop the skill of being aware of what you're doing mentally, verbally, physically. What are you doing with your mind? What are you doing with your words? What are you doing with your body? And awaken to the full impact of the importance of those actions. And that's how the Pure Land appears in the Saha world. The state of liberation takes place here and now with this realization that we don't have to do things to make ourselves and others uncomfortable and unhappy. We can retrain the mind and experience freedom in the here and now. The second one is keen investigation of the Dharma. So this word Dharma, for those of you who are here for the first time, has different meanings. Usually when you hear the word here, it means teachings of the Buddha. But it also means phenomena, things. And so by keen investigation of the Dharma, the Buddha meant understanding reality as it is, which means we look deeply into phenomena until we understand that the universe is constantly changing and all phenomena, everything that arises due to causes, conditions, and effects. And so When we look, talk about keen investigation of the Dharma, we mean hearing the teachings and understand how to apply them to us and our lives so that we stop clinging to the ways that we define ourselves and other selves and judging things as good or bad, and realizing that what exists exists because of these conditions. So if we're deciding to judge something as good or bad or indifferent, we're really engaging in a process that's not worth doing. There's a famous Thai Dharma teacher named Ajahn Chah who talked about this once, and he used a metaphor that I thought was really interesting. Apparently, someone had given him a thermos bottle. So I guess today's equivalent would be a Yeti or something like that, you know? And so it keeps things hot if they're hot, keeps things cold if they're cold. And he thought this was fascinating. Reminded me of an old joke. Three guys were sitting around talking about what's the most amazing thing, what's the smartest thing in the world. And one guy said, putting people into outer space, and somebody else said, something else. I don't remember what it was. And then the third guy says, my thermos bottle. And they said, your thermos bottle? Why is that so amazing? Why is that so smart? And he goes, well, put hot stuff in it, it stays hot. Put cold stuff in it, it stays cold. And they say, yeah, so? And he says, how does it know? But anyway, Ajahn Chah had gotten this thermos bottle, and he was fascinated with it, and so he started talking about his thermos bottle. And he said, if you like this thermos bottle or don't like the thermos bottle, it makes no difference to the bottle. The liking and not liking are all on your part. He said, you can take it and chuck it out in the woods if you want to. The thermos bottle is not affected by that. So people get hung up on this idea of judging things. And it takes a lot of effort to judge our lives and judge the stuff around us and judge other people. And we just don't need to do it. It's not worth it. It takes a lot of energy that we could better spend on other things. So how to not judge means you're sort of stop attaching to your ideas and views about stuff. And so people, wonder about this idea of non-attachment. What does that mean? It doesn't mean you become indifferent. It means to not judge. So like the Ajahn Chah's thermos bottle, what we're judging doesn't really react very much to our judgment of it. So part of the process of enlightenment means to understand that things are just the way they are. We love them, we hate them, we can get disturbed, and that's all our doing. It's the same with our bodies, our minds, our moods, and so on. We recognize them as impermanent, as not really ours in any meaningful sense, as potentially stressful. Then we recognize that judging them are not worth the effort. And so then what do we do that is worth the effort? And so, this is the important part. What can I do with my mind that is going to create lasting happiness, that is going to create a lasting difference for me? And part of it is to be in the present moment and experience what's going on. So, I talked about the orchids last time I was here, I think. We know that these flowers are only going to look like this briefly, and then they'll start to wilt because they're made up of other things. They're compounded things. They're inconstant. So no amount of wishing it otherwise or telling it to do otherwise or anything is going to keep that from happening. They're going to become compost no matter what we think. But if we accept them the way they are, we can experience their beauty while they're fresh. And we can also experience their value as fertilizer for the next round of flowers. So there's a saying that you encounter in Zen, when you're enlightened, the trees and rocks are enlightened too. So this means that when we create an enlightened mind, we live in an enlightened world. We recognize that because things are the way they are, and that's fine. There's stress and inconstancy and all of that, but there's also beauty. Because there's stress and inconstancy, if the days didn't get shorter as the earth moved around the sun, they wouldn't get longer. The growing season didn't end there wouldn't be a next growing season. So the third factor of awakening is energy. It means putting effort toward things that lead to freedom. The Buddha revealed a path, and his example can serve as an object of faith and as a refuge. He said, be islands unto yourselves, be your own refuge. So it's up to us to travel the path. You can listen to me and all the famous Dharma teachers in the world all you want to, but if you don't actually walk the path, you don't get anywhere. So enlightenment means an ongoing effort to let go of things that lead to stress and develop those things that are good and helpful and to promote the good that already exists. So this means not only being mindful and understanding what's going on, but being diligent about it. Think about what the Buddha said when he sat beneath the Bodhi tree, determined not to get up until he was enlightened. He said, my blood may dry up and my bones crumble to dust, but I won't rest until I have awakened. So what if we approach life that way, that kind of commitment? I'm going to really do this. You know, a lot of us, including myself, I have mornings like this. You know, even to sit still on a cushion for 25 minutes is almost more than we could take, right? But if we live our lives really authentically and say, I'm going to really work this stuff, then we'll experience the benefit for ourselves. Fourth factor of enlightenment is happiness. So, you know, I've just been talking about all this stuff about impermanence and how to hard work and all of that. And you're sitting here going, why would I want to do that? Well, because it leads to freedom. It leads to happiness. We tend to think of happiness as something that sort of occurs or arises because we get things that we want. But happiness is really something we do. We cultivate it. One thing, by learning to recognize the difference between pleasure and true happiness. Pleasant feelings are fine, but they're momentary and they're fleeting. And you should enjoy them, but don't let your happiness depend on externals. Develop those things that come from your heart that lead to deeper happiness. Fifth and sixth factor of enlightenment are calm and concentration. And those things come from having an orderly mind. And when you learn how to kind of direct your mind in skillful ways so you have an orderly mind, then that allows you to also have a calm mind. Even if the world around you is chaotic, the wind can blow across the surface of the pond out there and it stirs things up, but when the wind stops to blow, the pond starts to settle down. If we can do the same thing with our minds, things can come along and ruffle us, but if we know that If we're grounded and we learn how to let our minds settle down, then they quickly become clear and calm again. The final factor of enlightenment is equanimity. And this means to be able to encounter the difficulties of life without letting it cause our minds to waver too much. Think about the mind as like a gyroscope. You ever have one of these gyroscopes when you were a kid? You could, you know, spin it and it would stay real stable. Mind can be kind of like that. That's a very active thing. It's not going to sleep. It's being steady. And a gyroscope keeps its balance no matter what happens. You can rest it on the palm of your hand and move it around and it's still going to stay upright. And you can learn to do that with your mind also. Equanimity doesn't mean indifference. Sometimes I'll hear people talk about it like, well, there's nothing good, there's nothing bad, you know, it's all the same. It's not really all the same. It means we can experience good, we can experience bad, we can experience indifference, but our mind stays balanced, our mind stays steady. And so part of that comes from understanding things like karma, how it comes into play. Do a good thing, you get a good result. Do a bad thing, you get a bad result. Everything that is here because of things that have already happened. And so if we find ourselves in the present moment and move from this point, then we see that what happens around us and to us happens as a result of causes and conditions. And so with that, we can start freeing ourselves from the tyranny of the shoulds and the shouldn'ts that disturb us and let those things fall away. So there's a story about this scholar who he's an expert on the Diamond Sutra, which if you've ever read that, is very obscure stuff, goes deeply into the teachings of sort of deep, profound wisdom. And it takes a lot to really understand it. And this guy had spent years and years delving deeply into the Diamond Sutra and written reams and reams of paper of commentaries about the Diamond Sutra. And he heard something about a Zen master and saying something that seemed to kind of conflict with what he had understood from all of his own scholarship. So he decided he would go and straighten this Zen master out, tell him how things really were. And so he packed up all of his commentaries on the Diamond Sutra into a pack and put them on his back and started on his way. And he stopped at a little tea house for refreshments. And there was a woman there who came up and, you know, asked him what he wanted and all that kind of thing. And she said, "What's in that pack, that heavy pack that you're carrying?" And he says, "It's my commentaries on the Diamond Sutra." "So, I've read that. It says, past mind cannot be held. Present mind cannot be held. Future mind cannot be held. What mind are you going to refresh with your tea and cakes?" And he realized that this woman had just said something really profound, but he didn't quite get what it was. And so he asked her and found out that she was a student of this Zen teacher at the top of the mountain. And so he went, climbed up the mountain to the monastery there, and ended up having a deep conversation with this Zen master that lasted well into the night. So he got up to leave, and they opened the doors to the meditation hall. It was very, very, you know, it was late at night, and there was no moon. It was really dark. And the master said, "Here, let me give you a candle." And he says, "Why don't you stay the night here? We can find you a room." And he gives him a candle and says, you know, he points the direction he's supposed to go. And just as they walk outside into the darkness, the master leans over and goes, blows out the candle. And so suddenly they're standing there completely in the dark. And at that moment, the scholar on the Diamond Sutra was awakened, because he realized that you couldn't walk the path with someone else's light. You had to find your own light. And so this is what it means when we talk about being enlightened, is find that place where the light exists within you. That doesn't mean you have to figure it out on your own and all that kind of stuff. There are people to give you guidance. And the Buddha gave a path for you to walk, but it's your feet that have to travel it. When you've awakened to this, when you've got this idea and you've started to develop some wisdom, and you'll recognize it, because you'll realize that you're reacting in a different way to things that used to stress you out. And you're happier than you used to be, and you're more accepting of other people than you used to be. You realize, I'm waking up a little bit now. So what do? When you've had some of those realizations, you keep going. You keep walking. So Dr. Chow said, if everybody walks out of here enlightened, we're all done. No. You're just getting started good. Every step of the journey is the journey, and you'll find that out there somewhere. It's Venerable Kaiten's sort of favorite mantra, I think. And this is what enlightenment really means. This step is the important step. And this step is the important step. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Adventures in Buddhism. I hope today's talks helped you along your journey to awakening. Now go save the world.